And we'll turn to the third case, 20-1538, Sapio versus Celux, S-E-L-U-X Corporation. We'll hear from Brian Conan.
May it please be called. Good afternoon, Your Honors. I am Ryan Conan, and I represent the appellant Glory Sapio in this matter. And I will go, I'm going to proceed slowly, that as the court will notice my strong accent, so that you can hear what I will be speaking of. And at any time, any judge, if you don't catch what I say, you could stop me so I could go slowly, because I don't want Your Honor to miss what will come out of your mouth. That would be prejudicial to my client. So, Your Honor, this court should reverse the lower court's decision in this matter, because the circumstances surrounding my client termination gave rise to inference of discrimination. And this is really what this case is about, because it's the only issue that the lower court ruled up on. So as the court will notice, my client is of Asian descent, and she's been the executive assistant to the vice president of the Celux Corporation. She has an unblemished record. She even has a raise and promotion, and she was working pretty well. And then when she was informed by an employer that not that she's been terminated, but her position has been eliminated. So, which means that position never existed. So then she will no longer be able to work. And the position is the executive assistant to the vice president. So as such, she left an employer. Come to find out 6 months later that in fact, the position has not been eliminated, but instead, and someone out of the protected class has been hired to be the executive assistant to the vice president, the same position she was holding. And this is why she brought this case, because following this court precedent, which was said in Little John, that if someone out of the protected class was terminated, it should at least give the presumption that she was discriminated against. And this is what she alleged in the complaint. However, the lower court dismissed the case because for the lower court, the fourth prong was not pleaded by my client. So the lower court actually disregarded numerous precedents from this court, because my client showed, and my brief will show that as well, that she was a member of the protected class, and she was terminated, and she was replaced by another person that she named, which was of a Caucasian descent, to assume a position. So based upon that, I would ask this court to remand this case to the lower court so that an appropriate decision can be entered. My client's position is not just that she was terminated, but the fact that the employer misrepresented to her that she that the position no longer existed would give her a right to believe, or reason to believe, that in fact she was discriminated against.
Excuse me. Your first 3 minutes have expired.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. So if you have more some questions for me, Your Honor, before I continue, but I expired my first 3 minutes.
I have a question.
Yes, go ahead.
Is there any evidence of discriminatory animus besides the fact that this position stayed open for 6 months and then it was filled by someone who was Caucasian? Is there any evidence of animus, which is something that you must show or at least allege?
Yes, Your Honor, the position did not stay open for 6 months, Your Honor. She learned that somebody was occupying this position after 6 months, but we don't know if the position was open for 6 months. It might have been filled right after she left. We didn't get the chance to get to that, although the law requires that at this stage, at least the plaintiff need to be afforded at least the discovery so she can see what will really happen. Now, my client did not witness anything that would suggest discrimination against her. But the fact that she's being misrepresented and lied to me, could qualify as a subsequent event that would lead to discrimination. Simply put, I would say that this panel today has three members. Suppose they come and they say, okay, we no longer need three members, we need only two. And one is gone, and the day after you come, to find out that it was actually three, that we never took one judge of the panel out, I mean, that will raise some suspicion. So even though she did not witness anybody alleging anything that would be discriminatory, but the fact that she was misrepresented to and told that a position was eliminated when in fact it wasn't, could qualify as well. And this is what we allege in our complaint and also in our brief. I don't know if that answers the question, but.
Any questions, Judge Pooler?
Well, I don't think you've answered my question completely, counsel. I know that we have said that an inference of discrimination arises when an employer replaces a terminated or demoted employee with an individual outside the employer's protected class. But you have to have something to persuade us that all this was because of your client's protected class. And there is nothing in the record about this replacement, whether she was doing the same job, whether she worked. I mean, your client never worked for the vice president Kinder, who took this executive assistant. We don't have enough. There's no allegation that this was done because there was animus toward your client. See if you could help me with that.
That's what I just said, that although there's no allegation pertaining to that, but what about the misrepresentation? Why would they lie to her? Why would they say that your position is eliminated? Could that not qualify as a subsequent event that they did?
You don't in fact know if the position was eliminated and subsequently a new position was created. You don't know that, and we can't tell that from your allegations.
Well, my position is that in order to get rid of my client, they lied to her that a position was eliminated. That's what they told her. But in fact, she realized that the position was never eliminated, that it was the same position, and the person who was now holding that position was also named as a Caucasian descent. So in my complaint, I'm alleging that the same position existed, and then now it's somebody else who's assuming that position.
All right, thank you. So,
Judge Bianco?
I have no questions.
All right, so Mr. Conan, you've reserved 3 minutes, but let's hear now from Mr. Manfredo.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Robert Manfredo of Bond, Chenick & King on behalf of appellees, Salux Corporation, Yvonne Rivera, and Ed Wolf. This court should affirm the district court's decision in order to dismiss appellant's amended complaint for two reasons, Your Honors. First, The district court properly held that appellants failed to plead a plausible claim of race discrimination under Section 1981 and the Human Rights Law. And second, although the district court didn't reach the issue, the complaint should also be dismissed because appellant signed a valid and unambiguous waiver and release that bars her claim. As the appellant pointed out in his argument and in his brief, the appellant was advised on January 10th of 2018 by Mr. Wolf and Ms. Rivera that her position was being eliminated and that she was being terminated from her employment with Salux Corporation. At that time, Ms. Rivera and Mr. Wolf provided the appellant with a separation agreement that offered to pay her 2 months of severance. It's undisputed that on January 29th, 2018, 19 days later, after that initial meeting, the appellant signed the separation agreement, which included a valid and unambiguous release of her claim against the appellees related to her employment. Now, in the appellant's initial brief, the appellant did not only omit any discussion regarding the validity of this release, but also failed to include the agreement itself, which was submitted in support of appellee's motion to dismiss to the district court. That agreement is now before your honors as part of appellee's supplemental appendix. In a reply brief, appellant argues that the issue of the release is burdensome and not properly before the court. This is inaccurate in both respects. In Booking versus General Star Management Company, this court held that it has discretion to consider issues that were raised, briefed, and argued in the district court, but that were not reached. Because this issue was thoroughly briefed at the district court level and is dispositive of appellant's claim, it is within the discretion of this court to now rely on those arguments in affirming the dismissal of plaintiff's amended complaint. The release at issue specifically references appellant's claims under Section 1981, the Human Rights Law, and common law claims, including appellant's claims for fraud. The only issue remaining is whether the agreement was entered into knowingly and voluntarily. To analyze that part of the issue, Your Honors, we would look at Borman versus AT&T Communication, which sets forward a six-factor test for determining whether the release was signed knowingly and voluntarily. And the first factor in that test is looking at the clarity of the agreement. And in looking at the clarity of the agreement, the appellant actually acknowledged in signing the agreement that she knowingly released and discharged the employer from all claims which she ever had that related to her employment with Salux Corporation. That factor weighs decidedly in favor of enforceability of this agreement. The second factor is looking at the time that the plaintiff had to consider the actual agreement itself. In accordance with the OBWVPA, plaintiff had 21 days to consider the agreement and actually took 19 days to sign it. I see my first 3 minutes, I believe, are up, so I'll stop for a moment if any of your honors have any questions.
Thank you. Judge Pooler, any questions?
I have no questions. Thank you.
Judge Bianco?
Yes, I want to go to the pleading issue, Mr. Manfredo. I guess the law of this circuit is, I think, fairly clear. Zimmerman, I'll quote you Zimmerman, the mere fact that a plaintiff was replaced by someone outside the protected class will suffice for the required inference of discrimination at the prima facie stage of the Title VII analysis. We repeated that in Cook. We said that in Littlejohn. We said that in Carlton, the Mystic Transportation. And I could cite other cases. And then there are a whole host of district court cases adhering to that rule. So my question to you isn't that what's being alleged here, is that she was replaced by someone outside her protected class for the exact same position that she has? So why isn't that sufficient? Obviously, as Judge Pooler pointed out, she's going to have to ultimately demonstrate, you know, discriminatory animus. But we're talking about the pleading stage, which we describe as minimal. So aren't you asking us to do something completely inconsistent with our precedent?
Your Honor, I don't believe that it's entirely inconsistent with precedent. When we look at the cases like Littlejohn, Carlton, Bella Cruz, Cook, there are, in addition to the allegations related to replacement of the individual with someone from a different protected classification, there are, generally speaking, other allegations relied on by the court.
I understand there may be other facts in those cases, but you heard the quote. The quote is pretty clear, and you've repeated that quote numerous times. So I don't know that whether another case may have had some other fact in or not is dispositive. We said at this stage, at least at the pleading stage, all you have to say, and as your adversary pointed out, they actually have more than that. They don't just have that she was replaced by a Caucasian for the exact same position. They allege further that she was given a false reason, that she was told it was because they're eliminating the position, which she alleges that they did not do. So she actually has two things. She has already alleged the reason is pretextual, that's a lie, and that she was replaced by a Caucasian. So why isn't that enough? At the pleading stage, whether she can prove that or not, whether that'll be enough at summary judgment is a different matter. But why isn't it enough at the pleading stage?
Understood, Your Honor. And I do acknowledge that is the Second Circuit's position in a variety of cases. And when I would look at this particular case and why I think it's distinguishable, and we look at the facts that are alleged in this particular complaint, the appellant alleges that she worked for both the director of engineering and the vice president for manufacturing. That's alleged in her complaint. What she later alleges is that 6 months after she worked, she lost her position with the company, that she found out that an individual named Klaus Kinder hired someone in a lateral position who happened to be Caucasian. Now, I understand the court's precedent, but when we look at this from a factually distinct perspective, I think that you can distinguish this particular case because of the fact that this happened 6 months after her termination, other than the bare allegations that they've misrepresented to her that her position wasn't being eliminated. There really are no other facts to support that particular allegation. Ms. Dunham, who was the
individual. I don't understand. You're going to say because it was 6 months later, it wasn't like the day later. In Carlton, it was 3 months later. We're talking about the pleading stage. We're going to say 6 months it doesn't allow for that inference. I think that would be an extraordinary thing as well. And she did allege in paragraphs 29 and 34 that it was I understand there may have been other aspects of the job or whatever, but she alleges twice that it was to assume her position as the executive assistant to the vice president, not some other executive assistant position, but her position. Now, I don't, as Judge Poole pointed out, we don't know what the responsibilities are, but she alleges it was her position.
Right. I understand that, Your Honor. And I guess what I would say is that in the event that we were to look at this from that standpoint, and we were to assume that she does allege a plausible claim of race discrimination, which I do think is, again, factually distinct in this particular case because of the vagueness of the allegations that are laid out in the amended complaint, particularly given the relationship that she had with Mr. Kinder and what happened to her position as it related to the dual role that she held as an executive assistant to these two different positions, the director of engineering and the vice president for manufacturing. Again, I think that distinguishes this particular case in addition to the fact that there are no other allegations of any type of animus. But even if we were to assume that she can make out that prima facie case on the race discrimination claim, there has been nothing to suggest that she can overcome the release that she has signed that waived her claims against the company.
This is my last question. On that, as you pointed out, we have the Borman factors, and the district court didn't decide that. So you're asking us on appeal to basically go through the Borman factors and rule in your favor on something that was not addressed by the district court. And on some of the factors, we don't even know. One of the factors is her education and her business experience. We have no idea what that is.
With all due respect, Your Honor, I think she does allege in her complaint that she was a very well-qualified individual who worked for 7 years in an executive assistant capacity. So when we look at cases that discuss that particular factor,
What about the fact that she alleges that she signed the agreement because she was induced with a fraudulent statement that her position was being eliminated? Isn't that something she potentially proves, that she wouldn't have signed the release at all if she hadn't been told your position is gone and that she says it was a lie?
No, Your Honor. On that particular issue, if we look at the agreement, it has an integration clause, which forecloses that aspect of the justifiable reliance that she would need to establish to lay out a claim for fraud. In addition to that, we have advanced arguments with regard to both ratification and their tender back doctrine. Ms. Sapio did not return the consideration that was given to her as part of the severance agreement until well after this lawsuit was commenced and after we had initially filed our original motion to dismiss in this case. So,
what about the Obrey case that says you don't need to return it before the lawsuit? Wasn't the Supreme Court saying that case was okay, even though it was after the lawsuit was filed?
I don't know that they specifically reached the issue of that they could return it after the lawsuit was commenced. The cases that I've read in the Second Circuit, Your Honor, have said that the consideration the tender back doctrine works as a condition precedent to sue. That's the Davis versus.
I understand that, but which Second Circuit case says it has to happen before the complaint is filed? Which Second Circuit case says that?
Well, I, and Your Honor, I think when we look at the language, they refer to it as a condition precedent to suit, which to me would suggest that it has to be prior to actually commencing the suit.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Excuse me. You have 1 minute left.
All right. Okay. Thank you. So now, this is Mr. Kona again. Thank you, Your Honor. I will go back.
I'm sorry. I think I still have another minute.
Yeah, Mr. Manfredo has 1 minute.
Sorry.
So, Your Honors, just to briefly conclude, and I'll use the remainder of my time to answer any questions that any of you may have. I think when we look at this case globally, and I do agree that the district court did not decide the release issue. However, I think when we look at the factors under Borman and we look at the allegations in the complaint, we can satisfy those Borman allegations or Borman factors rather in deciding this particular issue. And the court does have discretion to look at that issue on appeal. And with respect to those factors, we can look at the allegations in the complaint, the allegations that are set forth in the record that's been provided to the court, and actually analyze those issues that we've set forth in our appellate brief. With my remaining time, I'll answer any questions that the court may have and otherwise rely on our papers.
Thank you very much. Mr. Conan?
Thank you, Your Honor. I will just briefly state that my client did return the money she received, and that is, it was when she filed a first complaint and the appellee filed a motion to dismiss. What the court said it was that she can at any time amend the complaint. But when amended the complaint, that's when she returned the money. So I do not understand opposing counsel position saying that my client never tendered back the money, which we did. In any event, as Honorable Bianco pointed out, my client was lied to, and there was no reason for his lie. Without the lie, she wouldn't have signed this agreement. Only because she made that she trusted the employer, not knowing that the employer would actually lie to her and say that your position is gone. I mean, we could just come to her and tell her you fired. But they know they couldn't because she's putting so much good work, good effort, they didn't have that reason to do so. So to say today that she signed an agreement, and based upon that, she'll be fired. I don't think that would be fair. Thank you, Your Honor. I'm finished. And I thank this court for its time.
Thank you very much. We'll reserve decision in 20-1538, Sapio versus Shellex Court.